keep everybody alert. So appreciate Helen Fraley's wonderful job on the special music, and appreciate that. And we all do look forward to when he comes. It's going to be a much different world than we experience today. And as you go through day to day, we can enjoy certain things in life, but there are a lot of things that are going on in our world that are rather unfortunate and difficult. And what we're going to do today is I'm going to do a second part of the sermon that I gave on how we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We are made in God's image, and God has created us as miraculous beings. And it is amazing just looking at physical human beings and their attributes and things that God has created, and how they all work together so wonderfully. And so we've talked about last time certain things about brains and babies and moms, and so we're going to continue looking at that, and we're going to look at come to some conclusions and think about some ramifications of what all that does mean. And as you look at the ramifications, unfortunately, we can sometimes see, if that's the case, we're not doing things that really promote how we're made. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and we are not doing those things that are conducive to optimizing the way God has made us, unfortunately. And as you think about, Satan is the God of this world. He certainly doesn't want us to be optimized and, ready for relationships and ready for God's kingdom. So maybe this will work. It worked yesterday. No. Okay. It worked last night, but
hit your pointer and see if it's got a light.
No, it's not going. No light? Okay, we'll solve this.
Technology.
So what we have is a brain, and we're talking about brains and babies and moms, and the thing that I want to emphasize is that as we talk about brains, brains are not simple. Brains are complex, and as we've learned things about the human brain, it is wonderful to think about it, but it's not simple. It's not just you push this button and this happens, and pull this lever over here and something else happens. That's not the way it works. The human brain is a complex interaction of the various parts, and so I don't want to oversimplify things, but there are things that we've learned and that we can focus on and that are helpful to us as human beings, and to understand about these things I think is good. And many of these things you've probably understood intuitively. You may think, well, I know that, but based on what? Just the way you observe things, that's good. But to have it endorsed scientifically, you as a mother know certain things about the interactions with your child. You learned that through the experiences that you go through. But what's happened is, as science, you may have concluded these things because of your personal experience, but science, through checking things out, has found out this is why these things work the way you found them to work. And it is amazing. So the question is, what is the cruelest punishment for human beings? What is the cruelest punishment that you can impose on human beings? What? Confinement. This is akin to that, but the cruelest punishment that can be inflicted on human beings is to be expelled from the company of others. To be cut off from the company of others. That is very hard on human beings. That's why they put you in isolation in prison, because usually it's a severe punishment and many people can't handle it. They want to be around other people, even if it's with their the other jailbirds. They want to be around people. And for little children, you see the little girls isolated here, and that's a very hard thing. And so as you think about the ultimate punishment that, you know, a minister can impose on a member of the church, what is it? It is that you would no longer be able to fellowship with those people that you would call brethren. And God wants you to be hurt by that. These are your brothers and sisters in Christ, and as you are not allowed to fellowship with them, it's to say, wait a minute, these are my brothers and sisters, and I do not want to be cut off from my family. So maybe I better assess what I'm doing or not doing or what I need to be doing and change. Maybe come to repentance and change in order that I can be a part of that fellowship again. So isolation is especially cruel for a baby. And why is that? Because a baby has less internalized capacity for self-supervision. Who is a baby's source of stability? The source of his stability is his mom. And to be cut off from that source of stability creates chaos in that baby's physiology, the way that body and brain works. It creates chaos because that baby is dependent upon his mom in order to have his own physiology and his own brain in harmony. And if he's cut off from that, it creates problems. Human children of erratic mothers are clingy. They're despairing because they are away from their mom, and they haven't been able to absorb enough closed-loop control over their physiology. They have not reached the point in their lives where they're in control. That takes time. That takes maturity, and they need to be close to their mom until that time. So this necessary intermingling of physiologies between a mom and child makes relationships and living with family and friends and neighbors the center of life. It is the center of life. We recognize that healthy human beings are not loners. What do loners usually become? They become eccentrics. They become odd. They become people like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, a strange man living out in the woods, sending bombs to people. Okay, so we all, if you are married or you have children or you have family or friends that you interact with them, you help each other to regulate your physiology. Still, even when you're an adult, but it's especially the case with a child because a child cannot regulate themselves. That baby cannot. And so they need to be tied in with other human beings in order that that regulation and the development can take place. So to separate doesn't mean that a child, if you have mothers die, and that's happened ever since man has been on the earth, but you've had other caregivers, grandparents or aunts or uncles jump in and take over, and they become the surrogate parent to replace the mother that's gone. So, limbic regulation mandates interdependence for human beings of all ages. But babies are in special need of guidance. Their neural systems, that is, their brains, are not only immature, but they're also growing and changing. And if that baby does not interact properly with its mother, it's going to be lacking. There will be things that don't develop properly. One of the physiologic processes that limbic regulation directs is the development of the brain itself. That means attachment, especially to mom, determines the ultimate nature of the baby's brain. The importance of limbic contact for normal brain development shows itself most vividly when it's omitted. What happens when it is omitted? As I explained last time, experiments have been done And you can feed and clothe an infant, but if there is no emotional contact, that baby has a large percentage chance of dying. It needs emotional contact. And so as you think about our world today, our country especially, how many children lack that limbic regulation and that contact on a daily basis, on an ongoing hour after hour with their mom? Lots of kids don't have that. And you don't think it has an impact? Now, we see cogs and gears here, and this is somewhat simplistic, but it gets the idea across. An isolated baby becomes a grotesque caricature because the nervous system cannot self-assemble. Let's say that you leave that child apart from its mother. It will not develop apart from its mom properly. It can't. God made it that way. It cannot develop on without its mom. It's dependent upon its mother. Limbic regulation gives coherence to the development of the mind, and behavioral systems are constructed without proper harmony between the cogs and the gears of the mind. And the baby's mind and body develop based upon the relationship between a mother and a child, especially in the early years. So if you want all those cogs and wheels to be working together well, then that child needs to be with its mom on a prolonged basis, on a regular basis, in order to rightly stimulate the baby. Love. Love and the lack of it changed the young brain forever. It was once thought that all you needed for the brain to develop was DNA. So if you have that DNA, everything's fine. But they've come to find out that that's not the case. The DNA provides a certain framework, a scaffold on which to build. But if you don't have the mother there, it's not going to be built properly. We know that most of the nervous system, including the limbic brain, needs exposure to crucial experiences to drive its healthy growth. And relevant experience is a necessary part of the process that leads to the brain's final structure. And the lack of an attuned mother is a shattering injury to the complex, fragile limbic brain of a child. So if your mother is oblivious, doesn't care, that child will know. It will know how you feel. You know, it's like I used my dog as an example of limbic resonance last time. And that dog knows every week when we're leaving. So he lays around all sad-eyed. He knows. I don't know how he knows, but he sees certain things we do, and he concludes, they're leaving me. And he's all sad, and you know, children are the same way. They're very tuned in. From the time they come out of the womb, they are tuned in to you. And there are reasons for that. And some of it has to do with hormones that are secreted. One of them is called serotonin. And so serotonin is what's secreted naturally inside your body. God created us with certain chemicals that are created naturally in our brains, and they are natural occurring, and they stimulate attachment. God put them in us to help us in becoming attached to one another. Serotonin is a chemical that helps maintain a happy feeling and seems to help keep our moods under control by helping with sleep, calming anxiety, and relieving depression. Serotonin is, as I said, is naturally produced, and one of the other outcomes it helps with is helps us deal with loss. It helps us to deal with loss. And that's where Prozac comes in. Prozac simulates serotonin. And so for depressed people, it does help them with providing that so that they can get out of their depression. And we're called the Prozac Nation. And the reason is because there are a lot of depressed people living in our country, and they need Prozac, which is kind of a sad commentary on things. Some of that is physiological, and some of it is psychological. you know, people have been hurt. They've had losses. They've had difficulties, and so they are depressed. Some clinical, and we all get depressed once in a while. You know, things don't work out, or we're discouraged in some way, and we can all be down in the dumps. But usually, we can come out of it. But there are people that need more than that. So not only does our body produce serotonin, but it produces opiates. Now, for all of us, we think opiates, oh, wow, that's not good. That's heroin and all these terrible drugs. Well, your body naturally produces opiates. And opiates, whether you believe, you probably didn't know this, but opiates make you feel good, real good, okay? So you feel very good when opiates are, you know, are stimulated naturally. And when you see this soldier here being welcomed home and hugging his child. So if you were to look at his body and the amount of opiates that are being produced there, he's feeling really about as well as he can. And he's probably producing gushes of opiates, and he's feeling about as well as he can. You know, if you have missed somebody, you don't see them, and you come to, you see them and you get together with them, you smile and you begin to have this wonderful feeling, don't you? And that's because you naturally produce opiates. The reason and the main way that they are produced is through warm human contact. If we've suffered, if we've suffered a loss, you know, you've lost your husband or your child, and you're going through the grieving process and hurting, what helps you? Well, when you have that warm human contact, you will produce opiates and you will feel better. That's why people need support when they've had great losses like that. And your limbic brain has more opiate receptors than any other part of your body. So that is the reason why it's so easy to be addicted to opiates, cocaine and things like that, because it goes right to your limbic brain and you're feeling great. But they are addictive. They are very addictive. And that's why they're so addictive, because you're feeling good. Why don't I want to keep feeling good? And unfortunately, it's a downhill if you do that. So if you've known daily warm human contact from a loved one and they die, what condition are you left in? You've known a certain level of opiate production. You've had a loss, and that production drops off, and so you're depressed. And you need warm human contact. We all need it. We all like it. We all want to know that somebody loves us and cares for us, and it does help it with that. Another thing that's produced here is called oxytocin. And on the left, you see this sterile hospital, and all of the little cubicles there are filled with babies. Okay, but all those babies are clean. There's somebody to watch out for them. There's somebody to care for them. But, and then you see on the right, you see the baby with its mother. So which is better? I mean, the sterile, I mean, who wants to be in that situation? Oxytocin coordinates physiological events around childbirth, stimulating uterine contractions and milk production. It's been found that oxytocin also plays a role in forging the bonds of relatedness. And when do oxytocin levels surge in human mothers? Well, that particular ingredient surges around birth, and they help a mother and child to forge a bond in the hours after birth. So that particular thing, oxytocin surges and it stimulates that bond between a mother and child. Common wisdom used to be to take a baby from its mother right after birth and isolate it. It's the worst thing you could do. High oxytocin levels right around birth point to a crucial relationship event, and they tell us that a mother and her child are meant to be together right after birth, when their neurochemistries are busy weaving the ties between them. And as you think about oxytocin, when is the next time a baby gushes there will be huge gushes of oxytocin. What point in life? Well, oxytocin surges in human beings at puberty, when crushes first bloom. So once that oxytocin, you're going into puberty and you're, oh, he's so cute and man, she's hot and all that thing starts going on. Oxytocin is flowing then, okay? So that's what draws us together, and we find those members of the opposite sex to be quite attractive, and but there's something hormonally going on in there. Let's think about language here. Children learn to speak without instruction. How many of you sit down and say, okay, let's say book with your baby? How many of you do that? You don't do that. You talk to them. You know, you talk to them just like you would normally. Well, I'm going to fix some cereal and you're going to have peas for lunch, and you're talking to them like you would anybody else. They're not responding. They're maybe just laying there. But you're talking to them. Maybe I'm the only person that does that, but you probably all talk to your babies, don't you? And they're not responding, but they're looking at you, they're hearing you, and they're focused on you, and they're learning to speak through that process. They absorb linguistic rules as a sponge absorbs water. You're not saying, well, here's how you diagram a sentence. You're not explaining this is a verb, this is an adverb, this is a noun. None of that's taking place, but your child picks up on your voice and picks up on the language, and they can intuitively put it all together. Babies remember their mother's voice and within 36 hours of birth. And within days, an infant recognizes and prefers not only his mother's voice, but also her native language, even spoken by a stranger. They prefer that language because that's what they're used to. A newborn doesn't recognize his father's voice. Sorry, guys. They don't recognize your voice because you haven't been carrying them around for 9 months. And indicating that these things begin even before they are born. Bathed in 9 months of his mother's vocalizations, a baby's brain begins to decode and store them. Not just the speaker's tone, but her language pattern. And once a baby orients to the familiar sounds of his mother's voice and her mother tongue and favors them over any other, in doing so he demonstrates traces of both attachment to his mom and memory. And all of these things happen naturally. We don't think about some of this. We don't plan it. So how does a personality come into being? Asked another way, we might ask, how does an infant become a person? And, I can't look at you and you can't look at me, and we can figure out from where we're at right now as adults how things went in the past. You have to go back to the baby and look at the baby and see what's going on there to really determine some of those things. People are united in relationships by limbic resonance. That's my looking at your face. When I look at your face and I see your smiling face, that's limbic resonance. But through limbic regulation, we regulate each other limbically with our brain by the way that we relate to each other. And limbic revision, we can change in our memories and in our thoughts, and that goes on all the time. You're not the same as you were a year ago or 5 years ago, are you? We're a little bit different, and the changes go on. And these forces combine to create, from an infant's unadulterated vulnerability and promise, a human being. A human being. And there are other forces at work, but we're not going to focus on them. We're focused upon these issues and how they impact us. So we go back to the brain. The human brain takes shape as a compromise between unyielding limits. There are certain structures there, and they're unyielding. But there's also within that structure a lot of freedom. It can go a lot of different ways. And variety flourishes within the walls. Genetic information lays down the brain's basic anatomy, and experience then narrows still expansive possibilities into an outcome. And after the template takes form, neural flexibility wanes, but often not to zero. There's continual correction, and ongoing experience continues to mold the way our brains work, ensuring one's personality never rests. A neural learning machine, our brain has a natural tendency to influence what we learn as we're young. That's really honed in and really burned into us. And as what you've learned as a young person, a lot of it's hard to overcome, isn't it? You can, but it takes work. So as you think about DNA, is it destiny? DNA, our genes, they generate a scaffold slanted toward, we can be slanted toward shyness. You know, some kids, they're shy. Sometimes we're slanted toward having a short temper. Some of that's in your DNA. And that's part of your DNA as much as having long bones and a fair complexion. And one brain's blueprint may promote joy more readily than most, and another person, they tend to be pessimist. It's just the way they are. And whether happiness predominates or eludes a person depends in part on the DNA he has chanced to receive. But is your DNA the final dictate? No, it's not. We know that because as Christians, don't we have a choice? And as Christians, doesn't it tell us that through God's Spirit that we can be renewed in our mind and we can be transformed? So there may be certain temperament factors in our lives and we may be pessimist, but we can overcome all of those things that are not pleasing to God. We can be transformed. And while our genes play a pivotal role in establishing some aspects of our emotional makeup, experience plays a central role in turning genes on or off. So in the genetic lottery, we receive a certain number of cards in our deck, but experience deals the hand that we can play. So what's crucial to this? It's called good mothering. Here's a limbically resonant individual. Okay? He is limbically resonant and he is looking at his parents' face. And what's he telling them? I don't want to be in here. I don't want to be on this side of the little barrier. Now, if this little limbically resonant child, he's happy if you're in there with him. But if he's inside and you're outside, he will cry. And it always does. So scientists have proven that good mothering can overcome a difficult temperament. And good mothering can do a lot to help that. Inadequate nurturance can disrupt healthy inheritance. You know, it can mess up good inheritance. You have a good personality as your foundation, but a bad mothering can destroy it or mess it up. So your genes can do good things for you, but mothering can impact it for better or worse. Believe it or not, children arrive with considerable assembly acquired. So when that baby arrived, did you think, well, this is it? All right, all I have to do is feed it, diaper it, you know, and everything's going to be okay. There was a lot of work involved, wasn't there? Considerable assembly is required. A child's brain cannot develop normally without the coordinating influence that limbic communication furnishes. The coos and the gurgles that infants and parents exchange, the cuddling, rocking, and joyous peering into each other's faces seem unimportant on the surface. As you go through all that, it's all developing the child. It's developing your relationship with them, and it's helping them to develop in order that they can have further relationships with other people and the great God as well. From their first encounter, parents guide in the development of a baby. And in his early years, they mold a child's inherited emotional brain into the neural core of who he will be. Now, this baby you see here, this kid has a temper, okay? He has a temper, and he wants his way already. When he was here at 6 months, I think it's in February, 5 months, he was already displaying temper. So if he didn't get his way, he just, you know, and so he's. So I thought, whoa, this kid's going to be a challenge. So my wife, or my, this, you know, my daughter has a spoon in every room and uses that to kind of tap him. No, you can't act like that. So you're already having to work with him. And but that's his temperament, and you as the mother can influence it and impact it. And you can't just let him run wild. You know? Otherwise, when he's 16, that's not going to be so much fun when he's like that. A child is born with hardware for limbic sensing, but to use it skillfully, he needs a guide. Someone has to sharpen and calibrate his sonar. Someone has to teach him how to sense the emotional world correctly, and his mother plays the biggest part of that. So limbic systems need training, and a mother provides that. And she's doing that as she holds him, as she nurses him, as she cuddles with him, as she sits with him, as he's around her. All of that is taking place. And you may not think about that, but you're helping that child to develop emotionally. You're helping that child to learn how to interact with other people, and what they have to be around another human being for that to take place. A child makes constant use of his limbic link to adjust his impressions. For instance, as they learn to walk, they're unstable. And you know as well as I do that as they're trying to learn to walk, that they're going to fall. You know, they're just so unstable and uncertain. And even when they're holding on to things, sometimes they just topple over and down they go. So is that child limbically resonant? Does he care? Well, as he's walking along, many times what's he doing? He's looking at you. He's kind of watching what he's doing, but he's looking at you, isn't he? And if he falls, what's the first thing the child will do? They'll look at you. They'll look at you. And what they are looking for is, what's your reaction? Because they don't know. I mean, if it really hurts them, they're going to cry. But if they fall and it's not a serious fall, they're going to look to you and say, well, what should I do? That's what they're going to do. They want to know what you're going to tell them. So if you're like, you smile at them, you're okay, get up, then they probably won't cry. But if you're like, oh man, that was bad, then they're probably going to start crying. So you can see from that interaction that you impact them, and you're teaching them how to deal with the world, how to deal with things that come their way. And a mother can tell whether it's a fearsome fall or a harmless one. And when a child senses his mother's fear, then his anxiety rises and falls with her. And after he compares what he feels with what his mother shows, a child's emotional read on the world moves closer to hers. So he seeks to tune himself in with his mom. And you help him to determine how he's going to deal with the world. So you may think about, none of that matters. Sure it does. So, think about the limbic compass. The child gets his first taste of feeling secondhand, and that comes from his parents. Only through limbic resonance with another can he begin to understand his inner world. And the first few years of resonance prepare his brain for a lifetime of use. And one of a parent's most important jobs is to remain in tune with her child, because she will focus the eyes he turns toward inner and out the inner and outer worlds. So he's looking to you. And if you're deficient, he will be. If you're efficient and proficient in that, he will be as well. So a person cannot know himself until another person, his mother, knows him. So what we want as we deal with our children are well-regulated, in a limbic sense, relationships. As I've said, a child begins life as an open loop. That is, he's dependent upon others. He's not independent. His mother's milk provides nourishment, and her limbic communication provides synchronization of his delicate neural rhythms. And as a child matures, his physiology internalizes some regulatory functions, and balanced from the outside, his brain learns stability. And if you're away from your child a lot, what happens? It's hard on them. If he's very young, losing his parents is very hard on his development as a young person. And prolonged separations can be fatal to a baby. As is the being around the parents are vital to the rhythms of the heart and his breathing and everything else. And they found that children separated from their parents have a fourfold increase in sudden infant death syndrome. The heart rhythms of securely attached babies are steadier than those of insecure relationships. And being well regulated in relatedness is the deeply gratifying state that people seek ceaselessly. We do it, we seek it in romance, we seek it in religion, we seek it in finding husbands and wives, we seek it from our pets, we seek it from the teams we participate in. It's all part of limbic regulation and the thousand other areas where we seek to get together as humans. You know, some of you are camping this week. Okay, are you camping with other people that you know because you want to be in the outdoors? Yes, that's a factor. But isn't it better if you do it with friends and you enjoy sitting around and cooking and doing, you know, talking and all the things you do when you camp? Isn't that right? This is a holiday weekend, so probably you'll have friends over. Well, why do you do that? Because you enjoy being together with them. And it's all part of this, and we help each other to have as we have these relationships. So in early life, limbic regulation is not simply pleasure. It is also crucial training. As a baby's precarious neurophysiology falls under the steadying spell of his mother, he first borrows her steadiness, and he makes it his own. A child balances his body in the same way he masters a two-wheeler. A good parent rights him when he strays. How many of you have taught your child to ride a bike? So we're taking the training wheels off. We're going big time here today. So what do you do? You know, you get him going, and then you let him go, and you kind of go along with them and hope if they start to topple over, you're there on the right side, so they, you know, don't go the opposite direction. But you're trying to keep them from going over, aren't you? And you're doing that as a parent. Without words and concepts and ideas or understanding, the baby's brain learns to do what the parents standing beside him once did. They're learning to deal with life, and you help him when he gets off kilter to bring him back to balance. So what we can see so far is that God created us as relational beings. We're not just a bunch of people living apart out in the woods. So we are relational beings. Parents, especially mothers, deeply impact their children through personal contact. And as parents fulfill their God-given responsibilities, a child is most fully developed physically and mentally. And through the process, a child is readied for the ultimate relationship with God. So the interaction between parents and children is all setting up the relationship between God the Father and Jesus Christ. And a good relationship with your mom and dad is setting the way for that to go well. Now, what happens if it doesn't go well? What happens if it doesn't go well? A distraught baby reaches for his mother because, why do you think it reaches for its mother? It does because an attuned parent can soothe him. He can't soothe himself. He can't soothe himself. He doesn't know how. So he seeks you in order to be soothed. As a consequence of thousands of interactions, a child learns to to deal with things himself, but it takes thousands of interactions for that to take place. To sustain a living relationship, limbic regulation demands sensory inputs that are rich and vivid and frequent. And our society overlooks this. It's not important because they don't understand it. The signature lesson of the 20th century is that there are serious complications as a result of the way we live in the 20th and 21st century. It's very easy for us to travel and go all over the place and be at a distance from each other. It's easy, isn't it? We have transportation, we have hotels, motels, we can be out on business trips, and we can be all of those, doing those kind of things. And unfortunately, we can do that, but our brains, especially babies' brains, don't do well with that. Okay, so we can force things, and we have the ability to do that, but it's not, what we're doing many times isn't conducive to our being the way we should be as human beings in an emotional sense. In our society, is our society geared for helping our children develop? And the answer is sadly, no. Although humans are adaptable, they're not infinitely adaptable. There are limits to what they can take. There are limits to what we can take, even as adults. And there are things that we can neglect to do or that we can do with that have a lasting negative impact. And our downfall is assured if we push our living conditions beyond the limits of the way God created us. We need to understand them and then seek to live within them, within those limits. So, what matters more than any other aspect of human life? And we talked about what's the most damaging thing, which is separation. So related to that, what matters the most? It's what we do inside our relationships. What we do inside our relationships. You know, what we do in marriage, what we do in parenting, in society impacts the hearts of our young people, of others, both as adults and especially as children. So we have to think about our relationships more than anything else. And these are all things we know, but scientifically they find that out. As you think about our culture, does it promote emotional health? Sadly, culture in the values we promote is moving away from emotional health. Think of this. The issue of being a stay-at-home mom. Okay? It's an issue, and I'm not providing guilt or anything. I'm just explaining based upon what we've looked at. As you think about a stay-at-home mom in our society, is that position exalted? No. Who is more valuable from a societal standpoint, a career woman or a mom? A career woman. I mean, and we might ask, do we as a society recognize the deep impact a mother has in the early years upon her child? And we can know that scientifically, but are we doing things to promote it? And do we encourage it because we want physically and emotionally developed children? You know, we should. But you know, I'm reading a book about that's about stay-at-home moms, which is quite interesting. And people get, you know, if you choose, you're in a career and you choose to stay at home with your children, you'll get a lot of grief. You will get a lot of grief. You wasted all that money on your education. You're wasting your talents. How can you stand it? You know, what good are you doing staying at home? And I'm not going to get into that in detail. But when you think, let's think about this. If you have a baby who is dependent upon you as the mother to provide for it the stability and the growth and development that it needs, and you are essential to its early years, and you as a mother take that child to the daycare center and you're not there for 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day or whatever it is, then you can't fulfill that role. And you have to think about when you get home from work, are you ready to jump in there and do that? No, you're whipped. And you may do it, but you have to push yourself, don't you? So everybody has to sort all that out, but you see that if you can do it, it's worth the sacrifice for the benefit of your children. And we as a church, we understand these things, and the church has sought to promote it for years. And however, we also recognize we live in a world that's been created where two incomes are almost a necessity to live. It's the way it is. It's the way the world has shaken out, and that's what we have to deal with. So we have a world that pulls you in one way, and we realize it should be another, but it's not that way. In the world tomorrow, trust me, there will be a most exalted position will be a mom. You are people. You will be shown why this is important and how to do it, and you'll. And it doesn't mean it's easy. I mean, when you get up and you, how many of you get up when you're at home with your children? You're a stay-at-home mom, and you're thinking, phew, I hope that baby sleeps a little while longer so I can kind of have some time to myself. Has anybody ever thought that? Or, man, I just can't wait till he takes a nap, and then I can take a nap, you know. We they wear you out. They're a full-time project, and that's just the way it is. One of the things that, so you think about emotional health, and we, mother contributes to that, but we don't really support that societally. Question, should babies sleep with their parents? Should babies sleep with their parents? Well, our culture says no. And why is that? Now, if think about it, an infant does everything possible to keep its parents close. Did you know that? They do everything possible to keep you close. In that way, trying to keep you close, they're tyrants and they're also enchanters. With that smile, I mean, how could you look at the baby and it's smiling and, oh, wow, I've got to go up and hold him and he's so cuddly and loving and all that. And they're just sucking you in because they want that relationship. That's how it is. That's how they work. And babies are really good at it. They're so cute and, oh, cuddly. And they can be tyrants when you won't come and you won't do what they want you to do. But that baby's efforts to keep you close isn't just a whim. Part of it is he needs it. It's a necessity. It's something that's essential to him. And on a worldwide scale, America is unique in parents not sleeping with their infants. Now, this is just a societal thing. I'm not advocating one way or the other. The findings have been that there's a lower incidence, again, of sudden infant death syndrome for children sleeping with their parents. They found that babies are fed three times more often when you're sleeping with your infant. I don't have to get up. I'm right here. And the baby probably knows that too. While sleeping with his parents, a child spends the night turned toward his mother with ears and nose and occasionally eyes, drinking in the sensory stimulation that sets his nocturnal cadences. He, in his breathing and in his senses, he senses his mother. And he sets his own breathing and senses according to his mother. He's tuned in to his mom laying there beside him. Think about this. In which arm do mothers most often hold their babies? The right or the left? Well, the most often they hold their babies with the head turned toward the left arm. And why is that? You may not have thought about this, but as you hold that baby in your left arm, where is its head close to? It's close to your heart. And that baby picks up on that heartbeat and that rhythm. And it helps to regulate that baby and helps him to synchronize his rhythms or her rhythms with yours. You might think about this. Does sleeping with mother, mom, and dad foster dependence? In our society, we feel, you know what? If I let the baby sleep with me, they're going to get into a bad habit and they're going to be dependent on me. And I've got to foster independence. And the earlier, the better. Well, they found out that you can't compel babies to do things. You can't do it. They have certain needs, and you may compel them, but it doesn't work well. In truth, premature pressure stunts the genuine, natural capacity for self-directedness that children have within them. Eventually, they will stand on their own two feet. But it's in the proper time. I think that's one of the lessons that we learn through growing kids God's way. Don't give them independence and give them things before it's time. And you have to do that with babies as well. Independence emerges naturally, not from frustrating and discouraging dependence, but from satiating that dependence. You fill up their dependence. There's a time when you have to do that, and then as they mature, then they will begin to stand on their own, and they'll begin to move toward their own beds, their own houses, and their own lives. So love and security are the patient midwives whose work brings about a fully developed child and ultimately an adult. So sometimes some of the things we accept societally aren't necessarily the way things should be. Breastfeeding. In our society, it comes and it goes, comes and it goes. It's in and it's out, depending upon the time. And the baby in the process, not as going through breastfeeding, not only receives the best nutrition, but emotional bonds are built as well through the touching, through the warmth, through the smells that come with that, and through being close to the heart, the pulse and the heartbeat. They all serve to balance the child. And we probably don't think of it in these glowing terms, but there are special things that occur. Does it matter who your child spends time with? Does it matter who your child spends time with? Many people think so long as the child's attention is occupied and he keeps out of harm's way, does it matter whether his caretaker is a parent, a grandmother, a nanny, a stranger, or an electronic device? They found that children from elaborate, individualized relationships with special people is the best. Its very special nature emerges from the development of the balance between the people involved, and that adult, it's going to impact that child. The conclusion is that some of the situations in which people place their children won't produce the same result as being with mom, being with grandmother, being with dad. That is the best. That's what's going to work the best. Daycare, the bottom line on daycare is that nobody, no matter how caring, is going to provide what you as a parent will provide. Nobody. And few employees will be inspired to love someone else's child in the fullest sense of the word. And if you say, well, I work in daycare, I don't buy that. Well, you know what? When you have your child, you'll find out. You'll say, you know what? I did my best to help these other kids, and that's a wonderful thing. But you know what? Nobody's going to care for your kid like you do. They're yours. They're the product of your pregnancy and your husband's contribution to that. He's yours. She's yours. And, I found this picture, and I thought this illustrates it. If you have six little kids to take care of, how do you love them all? You can't devote your time to one child. Because you've got Bobby over here punching Ed, and you've got to tell Bobby to knock it off, and then Sally over here is doing something else, you know? And Sally's tugging on you while you've got the fight going or whatever, and you're trying to take care of all these things. Whereas if you have one, you can devote yourself to them. Now, if you have twins, that's tough. And triplets, I can't even imagine that. You know, octomom with, what, 80 kids? That's a completely different story. How can you care for all those children? You can't do it. And, you know, if you have a child and you just put them in front of the TV, which, trust me, we all do that once in a while. I know when my daughter was here, we wanted to eat dinner in peace. And babies are not always conducive to having a peaceful 20-minute meal. So anyway, what we did was we got out the Baby Einstein DVD. And if you've never seen a Baby Einstein DVD, it's worth watching it just so you understand it. It's very simple, but it's bright. I mean, incredibly bright. And so she put him in his little bumbo chair, sitting on the floor, and so he's down there, and he gets the pacifier, so yes, I'm good with that. And then turn on Baby Einstein, and as soon as the music starts introducing it, he's already transfixed, just completely transfixed, and for 20 minutes, didn't hear a peep out of him. I looked at him while he was down there, and I thought, he's just a little man sitting there, completely. It was just amazing watching him. Just completely amazing. But Baby Einstein is an amazing... Whoever came up with that, they definitely hit the jackpot. But the problem is, with electronic stewards like TV, they occupy attention and mental space, but they don't nourish. They don't. Not the same way as you're holding your child and singing to them, you're reading a book to them, you're rocking them. TV can't do that. And think about what we want when we watch TV. Do you know what we want? And what we enjoy? We want humanity. We want stories, contact, interaction. That's what we enjoy. Oh, it was a happy ending. It was a nice love story. Isn't that what we want? Why not have the real thing? And it's interesting, you know, we created the internet and all of that, and email and all of that as a social way to socially interact. But you know what? People that spend a lot of time on the internet, you know, they're the most frequent outcome, they're depressed. It leads to depression. So, you know, something that's supposed to be a social technology produces an antisocial consequence, which is interesting. So there are consequences. We don't live within the bounds of the way God created us. We don't recognize these things and promote them. So there are consequences to that. We find that a third of American children grow up in mother-only households. And it's very hard for that mother to come home from work and spend time with her child because you're beat. Half of all American young people will live in single-parent homes by the time they're 18. And the outcome of such arrangements, parents who receive inadequate love, they have less to give to anybody, including their children. And children cannot bloom in a culture where adults cannot stay together long enough to support needful hearts. The emotional fate of children is tied to the ability of the parents to love one another, a skill that is falling into disrepair. Anxiety and depression are the number one consequences of limbic omissions. And these two emotional states are rampant in our society. Lots of people have challenges with depression and anxiety. People are isolated, people are filled with sorrow, people are bitter, they're lonely, they're despairing. And a person who lacks a stable center feels the urgent need to fill the gap with something else. So they turn to things that never really satisfy. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 3. And you might think about what Paul says here as he talks about the end of the age. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. And think about, you know, in the way that we live is one of the reasons why we have what's described here in the way that we deal with our children, especially in the early years. Paul says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves." Nobody else loves them, so they have to love themselves. "Lovers of money, boasters, proud." Would they be boasters and prideful if somebody loved them and they knew it? Somebody encouraged them and helped them to reach a balance. They don't have to boast and brag and be prideful, which is hurtful to others. Instead, they've had parents who've loved them and cared for them, and they're able to be balanced. "Blasphemers, disobedient to parents." If your parents aren't around and aren't there to instruct you and put the time in, it's easy to be disobedient, disrespectful. "Unthankful, unholy." How do we learn to be thankful? Somebody has to instruct us. Don't we have to learn to be thankful and appreciate what we've got? And somebody, it's a good thing if somebody's teaching us that. "To be unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God." Now, people can reach these conclusions apart from God as adults. But don't you think that if we had parents who were being parents and were there for their children and understood the vital role that they played, don't you think we could head this off? I think we could. But when we have our society in the condition that it's in, where we don't put that time in, then we see these results. And America is leading the way in many of these results. And that's a sad consequence. So the solution to all this, as you can conclude, probably ahead of me, is a family. The unimpeachable verdict is this: love matters in the life of a child. That child needs you to love them. Parents stand the best chance of meeting the young limbic needs because of the regularity of their presence and natural depth of their devotion. An infant's brain is designed for ongoing attunement with the people predisposed to find him the most engaging of all subjects. I mean, how many, you may see a child and you say, "Man, that's an ugly kid." But how many of you have ever had a parent come up to you and say, "Man, my baby is really ugly"? Never. This is the cutest baby in the entire universe. Look at what a gorgeous child this is. And you're like, "Whoa." But I'm not going to say anything, are you? Everybody's child is the center of the universe. And it may not be the center of everybody else's, but it is the center of the universe of those parents. And they're predisposed to love that child like nobody else would. Because so much of parenthood is giving time, attention, patience, food, guidance. Incoming emotional sustenance is indispensable for that child's balance. So the presence of two parents is crucial. We call it a family. And those two are the ones that are going to make or break that child in many, many different ways. So we've looked at what science has to say. And what science is finding is that the God who created us fearfully and wonderfully. And we have a part to play in the development of our children. And hopefully this helps you to see some scientific reasons why we do what we do to care for the kids that have been put in our charge. So I hope it's been interesting to you. It's a scientific excursion here, and we can hit different things to help us to understand what God is working out here more fully. So I hope it's been beneficial to you. I know it's been a beneficial experience for me in the things I've been able to read and learn about this subject.